Welcome back.
He went to his death like a true son of Ireland. The firing party he bravely did face. Then the order rang out, bells and arms on fire. James Connolly fell into a ready-made grave.
That's James Connolly, sung by the Wolf Tones there. And from time to time on this programme, we put one of our iconic historical figures under the spotlight and ask if they deserve their status. Earlier in the year, the late lamented Shane McComosh and Anne Matthews debated the relative merits of Countess Markievicz. Today, it's the turn of James Connolly, one of the leaders of the early Irish trade union movement, co-founder of the Irish Labour Party and co-signatory of the 1916 proclamation. Earlier on, we aired the largely favourable views of the man, but how much do people actually know about him? Let's find out.
James Connolly, union man, 1920s.
I just know he was in the IRA team, wasn't he?
Very little, I'm afraid.
I know his name's quite famous, but I don't really know an awful lot, to be honest with you.
He was a revolutionary, but apart from that, not too much.
Do you know where he died?
I don't know.
Do you know where he's from?
No.
Well, I know he died in 1916. I know he was a great union man, a great socialist. And I know, I suppose, that he believed in what he was doing.
Amy Street Station would call out from James Connolly. I don't know if he was in Camanham Jail or what, with Devil Ear the whole lot.
I sure have got no memory at my age, 70-odd years of age, have I?
I just know he was an Irish guy involved in the trade union movement a long time ago.
Well, I think I remember that he was born in Scotland. Founder of the Irish Citizens Army. He was shot in 1916, having been wounded in the battle himself.
An Irish rebel. He died. That's about it.
James Connolly, I suppose he's an icon of Irish in Irish history. I think most people have a very positive view of James Connolly.
Well, he's certainly an icon of Irish history. And although James Connolly is second in a long list of Irish historical figures that we're going to be discussing, we have been getting plenty of adverse email reaction based on my saying at the end of last week's programme that we were going to consider his legacy. Apparently, a number of people think that he's entirely above any possible reproach, criticism or discussion. Here's a sample of the emails we've been getting from all over the world, from America, Australia, Britain, South Africa and obviously from Ireland. James Connolly is an Irish icon. How dare you question this historical fact? Well, nobody's questioning his status. We're merely discussing whether or not he deserves that status. Gavin Mulligan says, I'm voicing my absolute disgust for RTE Radio 1's planned programme about whether or not James Connolly was a true 1916 icon. What kind of revisionist rubbish is this to come out with? He ultimately gave his life for the class struggle in Ireland in 1916. Well, that's one of the things we'd be questioning. Did he give up his life for the class struggle or for something entirely different? Michael Shanley says, I don't think that James Connolly is a false hero. He was the best fighter Irish working class people ever had, both as a Republican and a trade union organiser. I hope any programme you air treats James Connolly in a respectable and fair manner. Well, so do we. Cara Mullen says, I'm shocked and appalled at the anti-Irish mentality of your station. There's no question of the iconic status of James Connolly, and it's certainly not your place to dispute it. Perhaps we should make William of Orange an icon, which would seem to be more fitting with your politics. And Alison in Australia, taking down his name, turning him into nothing, is just another form of suppression. Have you no love for your fellow country people? Do you not love your great country? Gary McBride, who is studying at the University of Strathclyde in Scotland, voices his disgust at RTE, says, I have studied the man in depth and his sacrifice gave Ireland nationhood. In fact, if it wasn't for Connolly or the other leaders of 1916, there would be no RTE. I feel very strongly about this and I think it's an insult to the man and a continued push by revisionist anti-Republican historians to slander and belittle the men of 1916. Maura McNally says, how dare RTE declare James Connolly a false icon? Well, we haven't. We're discussing the matter. I am sure you will roll out the revisionist and the anti-Republican and anti-socialist vomit historians to back up this false assertion, but the people know the truth. We had one, I think, I certainly only saw one, of literally dozens of email voicing are speaking in favour of even discussing the matter. It's from Pearse McHenry of UCC, who says, I happen to be an admirer of Connolly's and have read all his work, although whether he should have taken part in 1916 is a debatable matter. Interestingly, Pearse's grandfather, Eddie Henry, was in the GPO in 1916, except he was wearing a British Army uniform. He was a prisoner of the volunteers. He was a medical orderly. He actually tended James Connolly, but Pearse, in his closing paragraph, says the worst thing that could happen in advance of 2016 would be to sanctify a set of received ideas about people and events behind a glass wall of unquestioning ideas about heroes and traitors. I think I'm going to frame that paragraph, actually. Right, I'm joined by Lurcan Collins, author of the biography of James Connolly in the O'Brien Press 16 Lives series, and by Padraig Yates, author of the two acclaimed works on Dublin during the Great War and the Revolutionary Period, A City in Wartime and A City in Turmoil, both published by Gill and Macmillan. And we'll be discussing the legacy, if you like, of James Connolly. Before we get into discussing the merits and the shortcomings, let's sketch out a bit of the background to his life, the kind of undisputed, if there is any undisputed area of his life. He may be an icon of Irish history, Padraig, but he wasn't actually Irish.
Well, it depends how you define Irish, but he was born of Irish parents in Scotland, as we know, in Edinburgh. And he grew up in England. I grew up myself in England, I mean, or he grew up in Scotland. He came back to Ireland, or he came to Ireland as a soldier, first of all, in the British Army when he met his wife. And then he returned again as a socialist agitator to work for the Irish Socialist Republican Party. And then he went to America. And he worked with left-wing organisations like the Leon's Socialist Labour Federation and so on, and came back to Ireland, worked for the Transport Union, became Acting General Secretary of the Union, and also Commandant or leader of the Citizen Army, which led then to 1916. Mm. So that's, in brief, his life. And he was dead before he was 50, so he had a very active and very varied existence.
Lurcan, tell us about his early years in Ireland, and I think also quite interesting and tends to be glossed over in a lot of discussion of Connolly, the significant years that he spent in the United States of America.
Well, the early days in Ireland as a member of the British Army, we don't have an awful lot of information about that because, first of all, he signed up under a false name and we can't search the records. We can kind of follow his battalion. They're initially stationed in Cork and eventually they end up in Dublin. And as Padraig just says, he did meet Lily, his wife, his long-suffering wife in Dublin, and they eventually married in Scotland. His period in America is kind of fascinating because not a lot of people even know he even went to America, yes. But he spent 7 whole years there.
And he was involved in the founding of the famous Wobblies, the International Workers of the World, well, the IWW, was he?
Yeah, well, he wasn't involved in the founding, but in 1907, they're founded in 1905 in Chicago, but he would have been watching proceedings going on there. But he became New York organiser, the head organiser for the IWW, the Wobblies, from 1907 right to 1910. So, I mean, a fantastic amount of energy over there. And he really developed himself over there. He wrote
Labour in Irish History.
Exactly.
In the USA.
Exactly, his seminal work.
Completely news to me, I have to say.
Yeah. And also he organised a newspaper there called The Harp, which was very well received until he transferred the managerialship of the Harp over to Jim Larkin, who managed to secure about 10 libel actions against it in about 2 issues, right? But I think he developed some great ideals over there in the States. And
a little bit more detail, Padraig, then, on after he returns to Ireland in 1910, he returns as an organiser of the Socialist Party of Ireland, but he co-founded the Labour Party, the Irish Labour Party, in 1912 with Larkin and William O'Brien.
He did. In fact, he was a prime mover. He proposed this, and another Belfast trade unionist seconded it. I suspect he had a backup man to second it in case he couldn't get anyone else. But Larkin, of course, once they proposed it, spoke at great length on it. But at the same time, Connolly, yeah, he brought back a lot of experience with him from America, which he then applied. I think he was more successful, though, as a writer, as a thinker, as an agitator on socialism than he was as a trade union leader. In fact, I think he was seriously defective as a trade union leader. The key thing was that he created that link, if you like, between the trade union movement and a political wing, I suppose in an ideal world, he would prefer the Socialist Party to have been the party, the vehicle. One of the downsides to having the Labour Party created out of a trade union movement was it was very much linked to that movement, which was very uneven. The local trades councils had the power to nominate candidates, for example. So you could have a trades council in the Midlands, in Athlone, for example, which was dominated by the AOH, and they would be nominating candidates. And you could have, in Belfast, you could have a very different political complexion nominating candidates. In Dublin, it would be different again. Dublin was probably the most radical.
AOH being the Ancient Order of Hibernians. Incidentally, one of the emails that I read out to you came from New York, from somebody who's a member of the AOH in New York. I'll give you a chance to come back on this, but I want to take you, if you would, Lorcan, to take up that suggestion from Porrick that James Connolly was seriously defective as a trade union organiser.
Well, I would counter that first off by saying Larkin tended to hold Connolly back a little bit. A lot of the letters that he wrote to O'Brien are almost libelous in how he talks.
This would be William O'Brien.
Yeah, yeah. About Larkin giving him an awful lot of hassle while he was up there in Belfast as ITGWU organiser for Ulster. But I think as well, whatever about him being a trade union organiser, he was a fantastic organiser all round on other things. You know, I mean, he organised the Dublin Socialists into the ISRP when he arrived here in 1896. I mean, they were in disarray, the Dublin Socialist Club. He organised for the Wobblies, as we mentioned. He organised the Irish Socialist Federation, the HARP. He was organiser for the Haywood-Moyer Defence Fund. I mean, his organisational skills I would not call into question. Let's face it, he was also one of the chief organisers of the Easter Rising. So to kind of say that he wasn't a great trades union organiser, how come he was brilliant at all the other organising?
You would make the point, I think, that his negotiating skills were not great. But, I mean, how important, how relevant were negotiating skills to a trade unionist in that period? Not many employers would have been negotiating with trade unionists.
If you look at, say, the Board of Trade figures for the period up to the First World War in Britain, and you look at the success rate, 34% of all straightforward industrial disputes were total successes. 48% were partial successes. That's an 82% success rate. So it was to some extent pushing an open door. The militancy was there. Gains were being made right across the board. But we have very little information on Connolly's record as a negotiator. The story's about he won a dispute here or a dispute there. But we have very little. And I think the key factor, though, isn't so much that. It's when he came to Dublin and took over the union, it fell to its lowest membership ever in 1915-16 to 3,500 to 5,000 members.
Well, a lot of that was due also, to, half of the membership, I think, against his advice,
but it was still,
joined the British Army.
Members joined the British Army. And I think that's a very interesting aspect, because I find the most fascinating about Connolly is his nationalism and his socialism. He denounced people who joined the British Army as apostates. And he also refused mortality benefit to the widows of members who joined the British Army and were killed. And I find that quite astounding as a man who had actually been in the British Army himself. So he knew the score. He knew that the men who had been in the British Army, who came out, who joined the reserves to get a few bob, 7 shillings a week on top of their wages, huge difference in their standard of living for themselves and their families. Those men had to go back in 1914 because they were reservists. That was the whole point of the exercise. They had to go back. I find that very hard because he knew this. And we don't know exactly how many, but somewhere around about 2,500 to 3,000 members of the Transport Union had to go and join the British Army in 1914. And I would have thought he would be much better off from a purely political point of view even, and a revolutionary point of view, agitating to get those men out of the army or supporting their families during the conflict.
But the point I'm making is that accounts for the reduction in the numbers of the members of the Irish Transport Union.
No, absolutely not. Okay. It's about at most a third. But I mean, the key thing is that the war was generating work.
Right. Okay.
Because I just finished that point.
Okay.
If you take 3,500 men out of the Transport Union in Dublin, they have to be replaced by other men because the employment went up in the docks, in the key areas where he operated, it went up.
Okay, so they weren't joining the union and they weren't replacing people who were going to the war. Look, and I want to
I also don't think it's fair to say that the union membership dropped solely because of James Connolly's lack of organising skills. Because surely the amount of effort that union men had given during the 1913-14 lockout was such that, you know, they weren't prepared for a big battle again. So there was a little bit of depression, general depression with union in the aftermath of 1913-14, and also the fact that Larkin left for America in October 1914. I mean, Larkin was the great personality, the great cult of Larkin. And I suppose Connolly had a lot to live up to in that respect. But I think in the long term, he did live up to, you know, his legacy shows. There's no statue to Jim Larkin in America. You know, there's a statue to James Connolly in the States, right? There's a bust of him in Troy. I know Larkin has a statue here as well, but
it wasn't for his they aren't there because of his trade union worker.
Well, yeah.
But the key, I mean, the really damning thing about Connolly, I think, and I still admire Connolly. I think he's a major thinker, and that's why we have to look at him very, very seriously and very critically. But it was looking at the lockout that convinced me that he wasn't. He wasn't good at this particular job. Brilliant propagandist, but not good as a trade union official. The biggest strategic blunder in the lockout was when he tried to close Dublin Port and brought out 1,000 dockers who were members of the transport union. All he did was convert those people from being men paying into the union, supporting the men who were locked out, into men who were on strike pay. He never regained his popularity amongst the dockers. In 1915, he was still being booed at meetings by the dockers because they remembered he had so mishandled the dispute in the port at that time.
Right.
So that is incontrovertible.
I want to get on to 1916. Yeah. 51551, by the way, is our text number. One of the emails that we got from Gavin Mulligan said he ultimately gave his life for the class struggle in Ireland in 1916. Well, that's a fundamental question, Larkin. Did he, in fact, give up his life for the class struggle, or did he sell out socialism by throwing his lot in with a group of bourgeois republicans in the 1916 rising?
Well, first of all, the whole notion that Connolly sold out is completely based on the thoughts of Sean O'Casey and the way he said that in his history of the Irish Citizen Army that Connolly gave up the class struggle for nationalism, right? But when we look at the foundation of the Irish Socialist Republican Party, he married the traditions of socialism and nationalism together. He wrote in the first issue of the Workers' Republic in 1898.
As a very young man, you're saying he had a history of association with nationalism.
Exactly. And when you hear this, he says, "We are Republicans because we are socialists and therefore enemies to all privileges, and because we would have the Irish people complete masters of their own destinies nationally and internationally, fully competent to work out their own salvation." Now, that's 1898. So O'Casey maintains that it's 1914 that Connolly starts to move over towards nationalism.
He was already there.
Connolly was always there, exactly. He was a Republican nationalist socialist. And I know the marrying of national socialism, it didn't really work in the 30s, but that's a different type of national socialist, I think we'll all agree.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with Larkin. He was always a nationalist. And in fact, if you read Labour in Irish history, the theme right through it is that the only class that never sold out Ireland was the working class.
Correct.
And I see him in many ways actually as a proto-communist, and Desmond Greaves developed this very much.
But what about the fact that he threw in his lot with people who were very far from him, people who had, for example, not offered much support to the workers in 1913?
This is why I describe him as a proto-communist, because if you look at, say from 1937 until the 1970s, you see the communist movements in Europe and in East Asia leading the struggle for liberation against foreign aggression. And they actually use very much the same template as Connolly. I think what's interesting is, in the case of the Communist Party, they substituted the party for the people. In the case of Connolly, he didn't have a party. So to some extent, he substituted the Irish Citizen Army. And as Larkin says in his book, before they went out in 1916, he told his members to hang on to your guns because the people you're going out with are not going to be willing to go as far as you are to achieve your objectives. And I think that Connolly became basically a revolutionary elitist and a militarist in the sense that he had an armed group which he was then going to use to achieve his political objectives. After the lockout, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that he had become disillusioned with democratic politics or mass politics. if the people weren't ready or willing to seize freedom for themselves, they an elite would have to do it, a dedicated elite would have to do it for him. So he's very much in the Republican mainstream in that sense. And in a peculiar way, he's very much in the communist mainstream. So he just predated them.
His association with Pearce and the Volunteers was a temporary little arrangement. And he would have, when the time was right, he would have turned on his former allies.
Well, he might have hoped to bring people like Pearce with him. And maybe he would have done, because they also believed that they knew what was best for the people. And maybe they did. The gamble they played worked at a certain level, as we all know, in helping to create a modern Irish state.
Can we talk, Lorcan, about his military acumen or otherwise? Because it has been suggested by some that he was one of the few, if not the only, military figure in the GPO who had a clue about what he was doing. But on the other hand, you have people who say, well, this is the man who said capitalists won't destroy property. And therefore, you know, he figured that we can plant ourselves in the middle of O'Connell Street and no one is going to bomb us.
OK, well, first of all, Miles,
because that's utterly naive.
Well, no, I'm going to get on my high horse about this because
Did he say that?
No, he never, ever uttered the words that a capitalist government would not bombard private property. Again, we go back to his first biographer in 1924, Desmond Ryan, put those words into Connolly's mouth by essentially saying that that's what he believed. Now, both myself, and I know Pádraig has definitely read through all the words of James Connolly.
Desmond Ryan said that.
I'll tell you what, I can go one better, because he actually said the opposite, right? He said that it is a practice authorised by the British Admiralty, the bombardment of undefended towns in open rebellion. So without doubt, Connolly knew damn well that they would sail up the Helga, or that they would bring in the 18-pounder howitzers and bombard the hell out of Dublin. It all depends on whose view you take on that. But I'm going to use James Connolly's words to prove that he never said that. You know, it's one thing. Also, like that other point about whether or not they should have taken Dublin Castle. I mean, Connolly wrote a few weeks before the Rising, Dublin Castle is not of so much importance today in the political or military government of Ireland. It is not probable that much blood will ever again be shed for the sake of the capture of Dublin Castle.
It was of major symbolic importance, though, wasn't it?
In one way, but
would have been.
William Oman, the bugler Oman, who sounded Fall In on Easter Monday morning, said in his witness statement that, according to the original plan, it was never intended to occupy Dublin Castle. ROC explained that to occupy it would be very simple, but to retain it would be next to impossible. So really, regarding militarism or the military plans, we have to include Joe Plunkett there as well, because Joe is one of the guiding brains behind it. But always remember as well that Patrick Pearce singled out James Connolly in one of his communiques, saying that he is the guiding brain of our resistance, right? I mean, if we're hagiographical about Connolly, so was Patrick Pearce then, you know?
Pádraig, do you go along with the notion of his military acumen, that he was
Well, I think looking back, his career and Mallon's career, for that matter, when they were in the British Army,
Michael Mallon was
his chief of staff.
Irish Citizens Army, yeah.
When they were both in the British Army, it was a different army to the army they were fighting in 1914. It was pre-Boer War. You had breechloader, you had bolt action rifles, you had machine guns. When they were fighting out, well, not Connolly, but when Mallon was in Africa, they'd be fighting Afghans with muzzle-loaded rifles. So I don't think they had any real conception of a sheer firepower that would be brought against. But in fairness to them, they were amateurs. They were grossly undermanned because of the countermanding order. And the whole thing was a mad idea in the first place, because it could never have worked. And there is an argument that we're very fortunate in this country that it was suppressed so quickly and relatively bloodlessly. And yet there was this huge political movement generated out of it that led to Dominion status in 1922. So when you compare that with what was going on in other parts of Europe, it was pure happenstance, but it was a very fortunate happenstance that the Irish people were spared an awful lot of the bloodshed that happened elsewhere.
Okay, you also, Pádraig, have a problem with his attitude to women.
Well, once I mean, if you look at the women he associated with, dealt with, they were mainly compliant women. Now, Larkin was the same. when Larkin set up the Women Workers Union in 1911, it was very much a marketing exercise to get women into the union and get them organised. The union had no real separate existence. That's why Larkin put Delia, his sister, in charge of it. When Larkin went to America, Connolly comes down, takes over, new broom, puts in his own people. One of the first things he does is get rid of Delia and put in Helena Maloney, who was an actress in the Abbey, had very limited experience in this area of work. But at no stage did either of those men consult the committee of the so-called Women Workers' Union. They were just put to one side.
Well, Helena Maloney had a very, very good pedigree of organising. She goes back to the 1880s. She goes back to the Land League, the Ladies' Land League.
There was no consultation. There was no involvement of the so-called Women Workers Union's own committee and said, what do you want to do?
Okay.
And say Countess Markovitch, the women he worked with were compliant women. Rosie Hackett, if you look at her witness
Countess
statement.
Countess Markovitch was a compliant woman.
She was with Connolly. Okay. Now, in early 1915, Rosie Hackett was being paid a peanuts to run the tobacconist shop on Eden Quay. Countess Markovitch was given a testimonial by the union in recognition of her services. We can't take these people out of their period. They had views, they had values, which we should accept, and we shouldn't pretend they were modern, politically correct feminists.
I want to get back on that one.
Well, first of all, I would completely disagree that Markovitz or Kathleen Lynn or Helena Maloney were in any way compliant. I mean, they were fantastic women for their period.
You didn't say Kathleen Lynn was.
Well, I'm including Kathleen Lynn. Well, right. I mean, who was very close to Connolly as well. So that
but
would
a very,
prove
a
that
very different
in many ways though. That she he didn't surround himself completely with compliant women. But again, I know it's often a worn-out phrase, but remember that the proclamation, which Connolly had a lot to do with the drafting of, without doubt, I'm sure himself and Patrick Pearce discussed at length the concept that it would be to Irish men and Irish women. I mean, he is a feminist. He is out for women's rights. He wants votes for women as well. He adopts many policies of the suffrage movement at the time, including hunger strike, which he becomes the first male hunger striker of the 20th century for political means, adopted from the women. So he copied the women in that respect. And also that fourth paragraph, again, that I always quote, the Republic guarantees religious and civil liberty and equal rights and equal opportunities to all its citizens. I really think Connolly is absolutely way ahead of his time. He's 50 or 60 years ahead of his time in the feminist movement in that respect.
And yet his wife never stayed in one place for more than 5 years. Yeah. A huge family which had to be brought from place to place, and it was all to serve his political career. And if you look, even when he was getting married,
or to serve his ideals.
And to serve his ideals. But even when
there's a difference between serving your ideals and serving your political career. You make him sound like a careerist.
Lily knew what she was getting into with James Connolly, and she was a backbone.
But even when they were getting
him.
Married, he said, you know, we're going to have to cancel that trip we're going to make to Dundee because there'll be a strike in a couple of weeks, and I can't leave it. So no, she knew what she was doing. All I'm saying is that we shouldn't have this idea that he equates to a modern, if you like, feminist, male feminist, you know.
Okay, Michael Shanley emailed us to say, I hope any programme you air treats James Connolly in a respectable and fair manner. I hope we have done that. A lot of comments coming in on text. I'm sure James Connolly was flawed, but he was also our hero who gave his life for us. Is this what we have to expect over the next few years? Attacking our rebel heroes as a sorry to all the soldiers who served with the British Army in World War I and who were badly treated when they came home. I'm not sure that I see the connection. The timing is very suspect. This is revisionism, no matter what way you spin your reel. I would make the point, if historians are not revisionists, they're not historians. Otherwise, they're basically plagiarists. Anyway, take courage. It is the role of a history programme to re-examine received narratives. Don't apologise, but better get a bodyguard. I am astonished that so many History Show listeners are so against historical analysis when it comes to their icons. Surely the facts will stand for themselves one way or the other. If the icon has true worth, it will be shown, and if not, should it not be known? History isn't there to suit preconceived ideas. Connolly did more for ordinary dubs than did Middle Ireland. He criticised the Brits for the awful tenements. Were it not for the labour movement, which made Connolly a saint, he would be remembered as another failed rebel. Lenin called him a failure for aligning to a national movement bent on failure. And Catherine and Manila, my grandfather, took part in the Dockers strike in Belfast, led by Connolly. I grew up in the Drogs area. The whole community revered his memory. Thank you both very, very much indeed for a very civilised discussion on the status of James Connolly. And we will be, I'm sure, we will get around to Eamon de Valera and Michael Collins. We'll probably need an armed guard for those who are taking part in those discussions. Lurton Collins and Pádraig Gates, thank you for joining us. Check our website, by the way, for photos and further information on the discussion. And seeing as how she came up in conversation, I just want to mention the 4th annual Countess Markievicz School, which will take place in Liberty Hall next Saturday, the 24th of May. Speakers will include Bernadette Devlin McAliskey, who will give a biographical talk about her life in politics. After the break, election literature from bygone decades.